Hi, I'm Xian Qi, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival, and you're listening to our Mind Spa podcast series recorded live at the Byron Writers Festival 2023. This next session, titled Growing Into Autism, is a powerful conversation between Sandra Tom-Jones and Mandy Nolan.
Hello, everybody. So nice to have you here early this morning. As we start, I'd just like to acknowledge that we are meeting today on Bundjalung country. I'd like to acknowledge the Arakwal people and Bumbaban people, that this is and always will be Aboriginal land and that sovereignty has never been ceded. So I'm going to put on... I'm so glad Sandra and I have a love of pink. Which will hopefully exude across the stage. So sitting on my left is Sandra Tom-Jones, and she has written this fabulous book called Growing Into Autism, also in the pink cover, just showing you so you'll recognise it at the bookshop. Sandra is an autistic academic, advocate, artisan and author. She lives in a castle in Healesville with her husband, youngest son, dog and hundreds of dolls under the benevolent reign of a cat who must be obeyed. I asked Sandra to write an introduction for me. So that gave us a really beautiful picture of Sandra's extraordinary skills and her cat, which actually calls the shots. Professor Sandra Tom-Jones thought that she just had to try harder when daily life overwhelmed her despite her many successes. She explains in this memoir, Growing Into Autism, that she grew to realise that she was autistic and that her world was very different to the one experienced by neurotypical people. So please put your hands together and welcome Sandra. So Sandra, isn't this weird thing when you sit on couches like this, Sandra, and it's sort of feeling a little bit, I was going, okay, Sandra. Sandra, we were having a discussion, you know, before we head into the book and the great territory of the book. I'd really love to start, we were just talking on the way over, about some of the challenges, and I think particularly for a person with autism, around things that people wouldn't even understand, from travelling here to getting here to having to make environments and have environments so they're inclusive and accessible. Do you mind telling me a little bit about travelling here and what the challenges were for you just to get here, which might include a story about Jetstar.
That's a challenge for everyone. Okay. So before I start, I just want to add to your acknowledgements. I would like to acknowledge the autistic people in the audience. So it might not be obvious to you, but it's obvious to me. I see you. We can pick each other out. Now, autism might be an invisible disability to non-autistic people, But we see each other, it's there. So thank you. Thanks for coming. I know that coming to these things can be tough with all these people and all this noise and all these lights and all these colours. And see, they turn the lights off for us. So awesome. All right. So coming here, and I know this wasn't what we were originally going to talk about, but usually when I travel places, I travel with my husband because he's like one of these people who just kind of life works for him. He's not autistic. Life works for him, right? The world was made for people who were not autistic. So he kind of travelling is all cool for him. But he's actually quite unwell at the moment. He contracted whooping cough. He's not going to die or anything. When I say not well, like I'm not looking for sympathy or anything. He's no longer infectious, but he's going to take a long time to recover, apparently. But he wasn't well enough to come with me. You can't cancel a Jetstar flight, you probably know that. So I'm super anxious about travelling by myself because normally he does all the logistics and so I can just come up here and talk and everything's all good. But I get to the airport with my carry-on bag and my carry-on bag weighs 10.1 kilos and it's only allowed to weigh 9 kilos. And I've got my hidden disability lanyard, right, you know, just in case you didn't know that I had disability, yay. And I kind of explained to them, well, actually, you know, I actually paid for two tickets. Well, actually, the festival paid for mine. I paid for my husband's. But, like, I've got another ticket that I'm not using because you won't let me refund it. And my bag's only 1 kilo over and I've got two seats, so can I bring my bag? No. Because you're only allowed 9 kilos. But I've got two seats. No, well, that baggage allowance belongs to him and he's not here. So, well, can I have my money back then for the other seat? No. So there I am. I'm about to get on a plane by myself. I'm super anxious travelling by myself. And they take my bag off me. So now I'm on the plane. I don't have my fidgets. I don't have any of the things that I need when I'm on the plane to help me feel safe and comfortable. But also, I don't have the bag with my clothes and my pen and my everything else. And I'm like, what if they lose my bag? So it was like a hyper anxious flight. There didn't need to be a hyper anxious flight. And then I got off the plane and I got my bag back. And I don't know how far in my travels you want me to go, but
I actually love this. I think the story really tells us about some of the challenges along the way that neurotypical people may not realise. So I reckon, keep going.
Okay. So the instructions in my little booklet said that the driver, the bus driver, will meet you at the baggage pickup. So I'm standing there and I'm looking around and there's no man there. There was one man. He was there to meet somebody far more important than me because he had a sign with her name on it. So I went over and I said to him, like, you're not from Steve's bus. And he said, no, I'm not. Sorry. I was like, oh. But she was very nice when she came, the important lady. I asked her and she said, well, actually, I think they might wait for you outside. But see, that's not what it said. So I was really nervous about going.
Because rules are important, aren't they? Like, be specific. If you say something, yep, carry through.
That's right. So I did actually find the guy in the end and I got on the bus and I got to the hotel. And it just, like, it's just been little things like that all the way there, like trying to find food to order in the hotel. And then this morning coming here, I had to walk from my room. Elements of Byron is beautiful. It is lovely. But it's big. It's really big. And they give you a map, right? And maps are great if you have the skills to read maps. Maps were not written for autistic people, right? Follow the dotted line, right? Follow the dotted line to reception. They didn't tell me that you actually have to look really closely at the dotted line because some parts of the dotted line have, like, grey shading under it, and that means there's a road. And some parts of the dotted line don't have grey shading. That means there's not a road. So I'm walking. I'm thinking we're following the road. But then I'm not on the road. And then the 10-minute walk that it was going to take, it didn't take 10 minutes. It took me like half an hour. And then I get to the restaurant and I'm like really late. And it said to be on the bus by 8:15. So I had to be on the bus by 8:15. And so now I'm starting to panic because I've got to be on the bus at 8:15 and I need some breakfast because I've got to have some breakfast. But they didn't have anything gluten-free on the menu. And I'm like, if my husband was here, he would fix this, you see? He would have thought to bring food that I could eat because he would have anticipated that maybe the restaurant would let me down. Then he wouldn't have got lost in the first place. He would have known how to read the map. Now, all of those things make travelling really hard. And so someone asked me, it was probably you, am I nervous about sitting up here talking to you guys? I'm like, no, this feels like a breeze compared to getting here. Like, getting here was hard.
Yay. Thank you so much, Sandra. Sandra was telling me that story on the way over and I thought, oh, she's got to open with that story. It's not what is ever taken into consideration, you know, when we talk about making the world accessible and inclusive for everybody. It's always from a neurotypical perspective. I wanted to as well just assure you, you have to, is your husband's Jeff?
Jeff,
is that we're actually known as the whooping cough capital here because everyone's had it nearly every, haven't they? It has been. So people will actually send back will send good vibes to Jeff because I think it's the most unvaccinated region. We have the most, unfortunately. It's not one of the things you want to have the most of. So let's actually just quickly on that travel thing. A friend of mine who has autism, comedian, going home with them one night, I said, follow me in the car to my place, right, at the end of a dark night in a car park, last people. I get home, he's not there. I don't know where he is. I ring up and he's followed someone else home. And not just followed them home, not just to a regular suburban. There's an area called Federal into this. I don't know if it's like to go home to a very quiet country road and have me followed all the way. Anyway, it was a beautiful story. So I want to get back to the beginning of the book, which is the talking around diagnosis, and you talk about your own self-diagnosis. Do you mind sharing with us today about how you arrived at that understanding that you were neurodiverse, and including, I guess, a little... It's also about you going to your family. I love that you went to your family and asked them and how they came back to you.
Okay. So I guess the first thing I diagnosed myself with was being fundamentally broken, and I guess that's probably familiar to a lot of autistic people here. So I figured out when I was very, very young that there was something really wrong with me, right? I was different to all the other kids, and then as I grew up I was different to all the other adults. I didn't get the rules that everyone else got, the way that I acted, the way that I moved, the way that I thought, the way that I existed in the world was just kind of different, and different was wrong. And so I just figured I had to try harder, that the things that I found hard, obviously everyone else found hard, but they just coped with it. And the things that I did that made me kind of stand out at school and get bullied and get picked on and not fit in and not understand how to do things right was just that, you know, I needed to follow the rules better and learn more. And I went through my whole life thinking that there was just, you know, something... I just didn't get it, and I just had to try harder. And then I had two sons, two absolutely amazing, awesome sons. I have the best kids in the world. You should all just be jealous. I've got these two amazing kids. They're 28 and 29 now. They're still two of the most amazing kids in the whole world. And both of my boys are autistic. My youngest was diagnosed first, actually. He was diagnosed a little over a year and a half. And my oldest was... Well, it depends who you ask. I would say he was diagnosed at four. He wasn't ready at that stage, so he was diagnosed again when he was a bit older. There was nothing wrong with my kids, right? They were just perfect. They were absolutely perfect. They were amazing. And I kind of went through this process where the things that teachers and health professionals and other people would tell me were the things that were wrong with my kids, were a lot of the things that made sense to me about my kids. Like, you know, they would sort of say to me, oh, you know, they do this and that's odd, or they do this and that's... And I'd think, no, well, that makes sense. Like, I get why they do that, you know. You know, and the school would ring me with things that the kids had done. And I think an example in my book about when the school rang me about my youngest son because they were really worried about him. And, you know, you think, oh, my gosh, you know, he's done something terrible. Why? Like, so we're very, very worried about your son. And so, you know, we've noticed that during lunch times and recesses and things, he doesn't play with the other kids. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay. He goes and sits in the library. And I'm thinking, yeah, isn't that what people do at lunchtime, right? Like, okay, I'm thinking, what are they going to tell me? Like, he writes in the books or he tears them up or something. Like, sits in the library and I'm like, yeah. I'm thinking, okay, so I haven't heard anything bad yet. And so apparently the school counsellor was talking to him and she suggested to him that maybe it would be nice to invite one of the other kids in the class to come home to play after school one day. And he said to her, you've got to be joking. Like, I have to spend all day with these kids. And you want me to take one of them home with me? And she told me this story and I said... Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I go to work. I can't imagine anyway in a world that I'd want to, like, see one of those people when I got home. And she just went really quiet and she sort of said, oh, okay, thanks. And she never rang me again to talk about the problems with my son. But so I started to realise that actually, like, they were kind of like me, and I thought they were great and I understood them and they understood me in a way that I've never felt understood by anybody. So I started to think, well, maybe... And so then I tried it out on them first. I sort of talked to my kids. They were teenagers by then. I was like, you know, does it ever occur to you that, like, maybe possibly I could be autistic? And my oldest son looked at me and he said, oh, Mum, seriously, where do you think we got it from? Oh, okay. And then I talked to my husband and I was kind of like, oh, Jeff, you know, I was kind of wondering, you know. And he said, yeah, I thought that when I met you, but... I just figured you already knew and we just never talked about it.
I love that. I love... It is... How did you feel, though, when that did that? Because what was the next step then for you? Would you recommend... Because you didn't get a formal diagnosis or anything that was part of the book, or did you...
I didn't for quite a while.
And then you... Can you explain what the process is? Because I think it's good for people to understand what it entails.
Okay. So for a while I was quite happy to sit with the self-diagnosis because I felt like, okay, I know... I'm very comfortable with that. My family's very comfortable with that. And I hadn't progressed to a formal diagnosis. And I want to be really clear here. I don't think that's essential. I'm not one of these people who say, oh, you're only autistic if you've got a formal diagnosis. There are so many barriers to diagnosis. The primary one for most people, of course, is cost. Medicare doesn't cover diagnosis processes for adults. Also, particularly for women, you know, the diagnostic criteria, the whole process is so biased towards male presentations of autism. It's almost impossible to get an appointment to see a psychologist or psychiatrist to get the, so there's a whole bunch of barriers. You know, self-diagnosis is valid. I was quite comfortable and happy with that. But I was having a conversation with my oldest son. I'm an academic. He's an academic. He was a very junior academic starting out at the time. And he was talking to me about how I should be more vocal in my advocacy for autistic people because he said, Mum, if you can't openly say you're autistic at your stage of your career, what does that say for us? You know, what does that say for people at my stage? If you can't stand up and say I'm autistic and I can do my job, then, you know. And so at that point I thought, okay, I need a formal diagnosis because if I'm going to stand up and start being a really vocal advocate, I didn't want to have the risk of someone coming back and saying, oh, but you think you're autistic and you're not, right? So how can you, you know. The process of going for a diagnosis, it's an expensive process and it's a, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to say arduous. There's lots of...
Do you mind if I ask how much it actually costs? Is there like a couple of thousand or...?
Yeah, I mean, it really does vary between... But, yeah, you'd be looking at a couple of thousand, possibly more depending on where you go. It's not cheap, yeah.
So that's clearly something that needs advocacy too, and that is actually so that people can access... Your finance should not be a barrier.
Absolutely.
To being... That's ableist to start with.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And the idea that, you know, Medicare will cover it for children, they won't cover it. I mean, so many people in my generation and, you know, several generations afterwards, it wasn't even thought of. You know, it wasn't something that people recognised, particularly for women. And so to say, well, if you didn't get a diagnosis as a child... We're all wandering around without a diagnosis thinking that we're fundamentally broken human beings, or we're wandering around with a misdiagnosis of something else. So I think that's a huge issue. It's very expensive. The process itself, you know, there's pen and paper tests and then there's tests where you sit there and you do, you know, it's kind of like you see on TV. But there's also like it's sort of an interview process where they ask you lots of questions and then they ask a family member a lot of questions. So with kids it's typically a parent. With adults it might be a parent, it might be a spouse. And I guess for me that was really probably the most revealing part of it because... Like so many autistic adults, I have been masking for so long, like trying to be like everyone else. And I guess I thought I was doing it really well and I thought I was acting like everyone. And, you know, it was really interesting for me when the psychologist was talking to my husband and, you know, so we're both there and he would say to me, and so, you know, do you ever do X? And I would say no. And my husband would say, well, except when... And then, and in this situation and that, and I was like, oh, really? And, you know, I had some really interesting conversations with my husband, even about things like eye contact and, you know, about eye contact and struggling with eye contact. And I was like, well, you know, I don't have any problem making eye contact with my husband. And he pointed out that, well, that was because I don't. But he just doesn't... he just doesn't complain about it because he's used to it and he knows that I feel more comfortable. But, you know, I've always... been me, and I guess that for me was part of the reason about writing the book was I think it's important for non-autistic people to understand what it's like to be autistic people, but just as much as they don't understand us, I didn't really understand what it was like not to be... I mean, how do I know what it's like not to be autistic? I thought that all the things that I experienced were just how everybody experienced it. But yeah, I would strongly recommend going through the process if the world changed to the point where the process was accessible and affordable for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Just picking up on that, because we're talking about masking, which is, you know, you did sort of talk about that then, because I think that's something, and that's almost like for women, because women are later diagnosed and can mask for longer, not being able to access is a gendered inequity around access. But something like eye contact, you know, so it's an example of how in a neurotypical kind of schools or in any situation, if you don't make eye contact, you are seen as being rude, disrespectful, not paying attention, and all those things. Do you mind explaining a little bit about when you're not making eye contact, about what actually is happening?
Okay, so, I mean, obviously every autistic person is different, and I think that's really important to note. So when I talk about things like eye contact, there are some autistic people who feel very comfortable making eye contact. I'm not saying every autistic person is the same. But for a lot of us, it's actually quite difficult. It takes, for me and for a lot of people like me, it takes a lot of energy, a lot of cognitive effort. So if let's say I'm talking to you and I'm looking at you. So what my brain's thinking about now is, okay, I need to look at Mandy. I need to make sure that my face isn't making any funny expressions. Okay, so am I smiling too much? Do I look like I'm interested? What's my face doing? What's her face doing? Look in her eyes. That I'm consciously doing that the whole time. So that leaves about 10% of my brain capacity to actually process what she's saying to me and what I'm saying to her. If I'm talking to Mandy and I'm doing this, then 100% of my brain is listening to the conversation and engaging in the conversation, and I'm much more actively involved in our interaction. So for me and for many autistic people, not looking at you, looking away from you, whether that's because I'm just looking at the ground or I'm fidgeting with a fidget toy or I'm scribbling on a piece of paper, actually means you have my 100% undivided attention, right? And if I'm looking you in the eye, trying to make eye contact and worrying about what my face is doing and trying to interpret what your face is doing and thinking, oh my gosh, it hurts looking in your eyes because it's actually physically painful, it makes me feel really uncomfortable, then I'll go away and I'll remember 10% of the conversation if I'm lucky. But that is not the way that most neurotypical people function. So we are taught to believe that not making eye contact is rude. It means you're dishonest. It means you're shifty. It means you're unfriendly. And that's really hard. So, you know, when you talk about masking, a lot of us have learned sort of strategies for avoiding that. You know, like you look at people's foreheads or, you know, look to the side, you know, you kind of, you know, find ways of making it look like you're making eye contact with people, or you force yourself to make eye contact because that's the right thing to do and you accept the fact that you're going to walk away and you're going to at best have picked up 50% of what was said. Those social rules are so ingrained, and that's why things like, you know, there was some things about the pandemic and lockdown that were harder and easier for autistic people than other people. But one of the things that for a lot of us was really challenging was all these online meetings, Zoom meetings, because all of a sudden eye contact becomes everything. Because it's not like this where I can kind of look away from you a little bit and look around the room. It's like you're here and your eyes are huge and they're staring at me and I have to stare back at you. And so now 95% of my attention is focused on your great big eyeballs and what's my face doing and am I looking interested? And am
Yeah, because your face is magnified.
Yeah.
And you can see your face reacting on Zoom
That's
too.
Right.
It's like
and
a mirror.
So I'm like looking at my face in the mirror and thinking, oh, my gosh, that doesn't look right. Am I making an unfriendly face? Oh, no, I shouldn't be making an unfriendly face. Am I not looking? And I get off the Zoom meetings and I think, oh, I wonder what that Zoom meeting was about, you know. And I'm in a senior leadership position, right? So it's a bit uncomfortable when you get off a meeting and you think, I wonder what that was about, because it could have been something really important.
So it's true. And I think when you're talking about that, the eye, you know, that's just one small aspect, but it isn't, because you think of all the adults, but all the kids that went through a school system that were traumatized bullied, sent to the office and set up for a negative experience because they were doing what actually helped them hear and learn. Like that's that actually hurts to hear that. And I hope if there's educators here that they're probably well aware of that now, I hope, and those things have changed. No, they haven't changed.
No.
You're very aware. Good, thank you. Thank you. I went, yes, absolutely. So I guess I want to ask now, Sandra, was just following on from what you've told us so far, and thank you so much, because this book just, it just gave me so much insight, and I felt it was so generous in how much you've shared in that book about what it feels like. It really helps you get into the skin and understand what the life looks like outside, you know, of how you think. You know, neurotypical people think that's what the world is, but it's not. It's just how you see it. So I'd love to know, too, Sandra, what was it like for you after the diagnosis? How did it change the way, because you talked about feeling broken, did it change the way you felt fundamentally about yourself?
Massively. I didn't think it would, right? Because I had self-identified for quite a while by then, I thought, so that self-identification helped. That helped me kind of feel more comfortable with myself. And I didn't think that the diagnosis would make a difference, but it really did, because it was like this objective verification that, okay, yes, this is the reason why I experience the world differently, and internally it helped me. It was like, okay, so yes, I'm not imagining this. It really is. This is the way that my brain works. It's the way my brain processes information. I fit in this group. You know, I'm an apple, not an orange. Like, I'm not an orange that doesn't work. I'm an apple, and it's good to be an apple, because I know lots of apples and they're really cool. I like them better than oranges anyway. So that was really good internally, but it also made me feel more comfortable being able to advocate for the things that I needed in my life, because up until then I'd always had to try and find ways of asking for the things that I needed in a way that, it's very hard to say. So like here with these lights, when we sat down, I thought there's no way I'm going to be able to talk to you for an hour, right? I'm going to get 15 minutes in and completely lose it and just talk nonsense, or I'm going to force myself to get through this whole thing, and then I'm going to walk out there and have a blinding migraine because of these lights. These lights were way too up. But I could say, I need the lights off, right? But I used to have that experience every day at work. I used to come home from work every day and go to bed with a migraine because of the lights. And I used to get to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I might as well not have been at work because the sensory overload of the lights. And so I would do all kinds of things to try and, you know, I would keep a hat in my office. So I would, you know, do all kinds. But I couldn't, if I tried to say to anyone I needed the lights changed, having the diagnosis enabled me to say, I'm an autistic person with sensory processing difficulties. I need dimmer switches on my lights. To be able to give an objective reason for the things that I needed to be different at work. It also, I think it really helped with a lot of my staff at work, because I, you know, and this is kind of probably more their reflection than mine, because I'm actually working on a sort of a follow-up book to this, which is about being autistic in the workplace. And what I've done as part of that is I've actually reached out to lots of people I've worked with and asked for their reflections. And one of the things that's come back is their reflections on my diagnosis, and saying that they, for a long time, they were really confused because I seemed this really friendly, caring person, and then there would be days when I would forget their names or I wouldn't say hello to them, or and they thought they couldn't reconcile that. And then having the diagnosis, they were like, oh, okay, today she's feeling overwhelmed. So in a lot of ways like that, it really helped, because it helped me understand myself. It helped other people understand me. It helped me provide kind of a language and to be able to say to people, no, I don't want to come to the after work social function because I'm autistic, I can handle a certain amount of social interaction and then I'm exhausted and I need a break, rather than just I don't want to socialise with you after work because I've had enough of you. Do you know? For me, it made a lot of difference. But the main thing would be that self-acceptance thing, to be able to say, okay, I definitely am not a broken human being. Like, it really is that my world is different to other people's worlds.
And in saying that, I think writing a book for the workplace is incredibly important because that was kind of, you know, what I wanted to ask you next, but I'll still is talking about, because we're talking about disclosing. And I imagine for some people when they get a diagnosis of sorry, a frog in my throat. That's the weirdest expression. I've had a frog in the toilet but not a frog in the throat. But anyway, I get very distracted when I'm talking, Sandra. I've got four kids with ADD, but I don't need to be diagnosed. I know where it came from. I think we know there's no getting over that one. I'm like this all the time. So what I'm wanting to ask is, are there times where some people might fear disclosure, particularly in a workplace, might be unsafe for them or it might be limiting for them? Are there instances in your experience when disclosure can be limiting, or do you feel that unless you take the risk that you're not going to know?
I would love to sit here and say disclosure is always safe and always a good idea, but I can't. There is always a risk. As I say, that was a big part of the reason why, you know, my son and I had that conversation about me disclosing, because at the point that I disclosed, I was in a Pro Vice Chancellor position at a university. I didn't have any aspirations to go any higher than that. It was where I wanted to be. So I wasn't concerned that it would impact on my promotion prospects. It did impact on some things, though. It really did. Even though I'd been in my career for a really long time and I could say, well, you can't say I can't do this because I'm autistic because I've already done it, I did notice among a minority of people a change in their perceptions of what I was able to do. Particularly, you know, one example was, I was going through an uncomfortable incident with a staff member. You know, I'd been a senior manager for 25 years. You know, ups and downs in HR, you always have those. Stellar leadership reports my whole career, because like most autistic people, I overcompensate. So, you know, I have my little rule book about how you manage people, and you can talk to any of the staff who reported for me. I did a good job of making them all feel looked after. But suddenly, I have this meeting with HR about my complex personnel situation a week after I disclosed my diagnosis, and she's come up with a solution. And the solution is for me to get a personal coach, because probably the problem with this staff member is my communication. Right? Now, hang on, I've been successfully leading teams for 25 years. There's never been an issue with my communication before. But suddenly now that you know that I'm autistic, that's what this problem must be. At any level of any organisation, there are risks and benefits to disclosing, right? So the benefits to disclosing are often massive, because you can ask for the adjustments that you need if you're in a supportive workplace, if you're in a workplace where people understand and are willing to make those adjustments. But there are also risks, because we still live in a world where there are all kinds of prejudices and stereotypes. You know, like as I said to you this morning, you know, luckily I'm so shocking with names, I can't remember the person's name. But this morning when I was getting close to having my meltdown in the restaurant because they didn't have a single thing on the menu that was gluten-free except granola, and I don't eat granola, and I was getting very panicky because I had to be on the bus in 4 minutes because you can't be late. And I asked the man, do you have a banana? Right, because you'd think a restaurant would have a banana, wouldn't you?
You would think that.
You would think that. Do you have a banana?
Five star, at least you'd have is one banana. Banana.
And he said no, and my husband's taught me social scripts for these situations, right? Because when you're getting close to having a meltdown and you're really feeling really overwhelmed, you have to be very clear to the person that it's about you, it's not about them. So I did explain to the man very clearly, this is not about you. I understand this is a lovely place, it's a very tranquil place, everyone's very calm. This is about me. I'm not very calm. I'm going to the Writers' Festival to do a talk. And I'm very, very anxious about that. And I have to be on the bus in 4 minutes. And I need to eat gluten-free food. And I haven't had anything to eat yet. And I'm very anxious and I'm autistic. And I need something to eat. And you don't have anything on your menu that I can eat. And if I could just get a banana. Now, at the mention of the word I am autistic, suddenly I become a moron. We have granola. And I'm like, you see, but I've got 4 minutes to get on the bus. Do you have... We have granola. I mean, seriously. So that wasn't a workplace, but that is the sort of thing that can happen when you disclose. And we still live in that world. So...
Yeah, that is. And you're going, this is a white staff talking to a professor. Let's be very cognizant of that. I do remember, and as a little girl, asking, it just reminded me of, which is a long time, I'm 6 foot tall, it's a long time since I was a little girl, but I was little. And I remember I was with my grandmother and she was asking for half a pumpkin at a fruit shop and they only had a full pumpkin. And she goes, can you cut it in half? And he wouldn't do it. And she goes, she didn't have your husband, Jeff, to help her. She goes, well, you can take your pumpkin and you can shove it up your ass. I just went, hero. We don't get to say that, but there are moments. I would have, you can take your granola and... But you did mention, because I was going to ask about meltdowns and that sensory overload. I would love if you could share with us today, you know, what that is and what it feels like and how you manage it.
So, I mean, I guess probably a good place to start there is most people think about meltdowns, you think about children. And a lot of people talk about... I guess if I talk about from a personal experience as a parent of two autistic children, and one of the things that I find when your child has a meltdown in public is people who don't have autistic children assume your child is having a tantrum, right? Your child is, they're throwing themselves on the floor, they're yelling, they're shouting, they're having a tantrum. And I would get people say things to me like, they need a smack, or they need they need more discipline. A meltdown happens when the world is just throwing too much stuff at you and you just can't cope with it, right? Whether it's sensory stuff like the lights are too bright and the noises are too loud and you're feeling overwhelmed, or it might be stress. Like for me this morning in the restaurant, I'd got lost. I was worried about getting to the bus on time, and so I've got this level of anxiety. So my sort of level anxiety was here because I didn't have Jeff and I was travelling by myself, and all this stuff's happened in the last couple of days. And then I got lost, and then I'm in the restaurant and they don't have anything I can eat, and then no one's coming to serve me, and then I'm looking at my watch, and then the man was talking to me like I was a five-year-old. And so I've just got all this stress and it's getting worse, and I feel like I can't cope. And I start to feel really anxious and really shaky, and I start to feel like, okay, I'm actually going to lose control of myself. It's not anger. So like when you see a child having a meltdown, and the way that I explain it to people, you don't have control of yourself. And the way with a child you could tell, and this is, you know, what I sort of try and explain to people with my kids, a child who's having a tantrum, right? If you see a child who's having a tantrum, it's like, I want something and you won't give it to me, right? Child's having a tantrum. You offer that child an ice cream, see what happens. They stop. You see a child who's having a meltdown, they have zero control over what is happening to them. Their body is having a physiological reaction to this complete overstimulation, whether it's sensory, whether it's whatever it is. You offer that child an ice cream, you know what happens? They keep having a meltdown, right? Because they don't have control. You can offer them their favourite thing in the whole world and it doesn't stop that meltdown. They have not got control. What they need is to be able to get that overload back under control. It takes time. It takes whatever it takes for that person to kind of reduce their overload levels. And for me, that's kind of the best example. And it's the same for adults, except when an adult has a meltdown, like we really don't understand that, right? You know, so when I have a meltdown, and everyone's meltdowns look different, right? I'm not a person who explodes and throws things and get, I'm not, but I will start to shake. I will lose my ability to speak rationally. I will just turn into like a non-functional lump of jelly. That is a horrible, horrible situation to be in as an adult. And like if that happens when I'm traveling with my husband or someone else who knows me really well, they'll see that happening. Usually they'll see it before it gets totally to that point, and they'll be able to steer me to somewhere quiet where I can, you know, just regulate, and they'll handle it. Or if it actually happens, like, but if you're by yourself and that happens, I mean, like, what do you do? You run the risk that somebody is going to think that you're dangerous or violent or crazy or whatever. And I'm talking about me, you know, like, I'm pretty harmless, right? I'm like, you know, 157 centimetres of crazy-looking old lady. Like, I'm pretty, you know, look at me, I look harmless. Imagine if I'm a large male, right? Or I'm a person of colour, or I'm a person who, for any other reason, to police or anyone else, might look in any way potentially more threatening than I look. You know, I worry about my son when he's out in public on his own. Not that he goes out on his own, but if he did, what if he had a meltdown? He's twice the size of me, right? And those are the sorts of things that people don't think. And those things can be avoided. You know, I mean, my meltdown this morning was avoided by a total stranger who's an author at this festival who happened to be sitting at the next table, who heard me. She's not autistic, by the way, but she heard me talking to this guy and trying to explain to him what was happening, and I'm like this and I'm like just about to look. And she just reached over, she handed me some food out of her bag that was gluten-free, and she said, it's okay, you know, have this, you know, just leave now. Just take these and go get your bus. I hope your talk goes well. Right, she was so calm. She was so, do you know what I mean? And like she, A, gave me something to eat, which solved my actual problem, but she also gave me the out. Get up and go now. Leave. Don't even try and talk to the guy. Just go. That's what I needed in that. I don't know whether she knew anything at all about autism or autistic people, whether she was just an incredibly kind, compassionate human being. But if you see an autistic person, I was going to say someone like me, but we don't all look like me. It'd be nice if we did. Wouldn't it be easy if you go, oh, autistic person, pink hair? It'd be so easy. But, like, if you see someone in that situation, sometimes that's all we need, right? I just needed to get out of that space and be somewhere. So I got out with the food that this lovely lady gave me, and I went and I sat outside near where the bus was, not near the other people who were waiting for the bus, but I just curled up on a little chair there by myself eating my little bar and waiting until I had enough regulation back to be able to talk again. So, you know, sometimes that's all autistic people need, just a little bit of kindness and compassion and a bit of space.
And get involved.
Yep.
Like I love that in that story. Hmm. Yeah, and I do love, I'm a little bit of a, I'm always eavesdropping on people. So that you get involved in what's happening and that you do reach out. You're going to find her in there. That's so good. What's her name?
Shankari Chandran.
Shankari Chandran. That is such a great... It's a great story of what... I had that happen once with... I was just walking down the street and I saw this guy. He didn't look... He kind of dropped his bike and he fell over... And he was kind of foaming at the mouth a bit and he looked really confused. And everyone was standing back from him going, I think he's got a drug problem. And I went, well, if he's overdosing, then, yeah, we might need to do something. And it turned out, which obviously he did, so everyone stood back, but I went, I'm just going to go through his bag. And I went, this could be a really bad move. But when I went through there, I found some insulin. So I went, oh, he's a diabetic. And he had some jelly beans in there. Mm. And within a couple of minutes, he was okay, picked his bike up, said goodbye and went on. But you have to get involved sometimes. And it can, you know, the worst that could happen is that you get it wrong.
Yep.
In that, when you're talking about the meltdown, I'd love to know how, because often we hear about things like weighted blankets and you're using a fidget.
Yeah.
Can you show us your fidget?
I was trying to keep it down here.
No,
because
I think it's
good. I noticed that it... No, I don't mind you seeing it. I noticed I was worried that the microphone was going to pick up the clicky noise and I was going to be driving all mad with the noise.
Wouldn't it be good if next year the Byron Writers Festival puts a fidget in their pack? Because I was looking at it going, oh, I would love one of those. It's getting fidget envy.
I know. I was saying actually to Mandy this morning, so my favourite fidget is knitting, right? So I am an obsessive knitter.
Yeah. Knitting.
So I knit everywhere that I go. And so when I was coming here this morning, so it also helps me with my nerves so much, I was like, I want to bring my knitting. And I thought, oh, no, I better not bring my knitting. So I left my knitting in my hotel room. I was so excited. And so in the bus and waiting for men, I was like so anxious. And so I was sitting here with my feet. And then I saw someone with knitting and I was like, oh, so I was really tempted to go and knock her on the head and steal her knitting, but I didn't.
Oh, that's great. So, yeah, so there is knitting. Just watch your knitting there.
Tomorrow I'm bringing mine.
I think bring your knitting. I said, if any festival you can get away with knitting on stage up here, it's this one.
Yeah.
I would hope. Why do... One of the things, and, you know, and I'm sort of going back to where we've started, but I don't feel like I asked the question, was about women and late diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that women often are late to be diagnosed? Or how do women, I guess, mask and get through where boys... I always feel weird saying binary thing like women and men, but, you know... Men tend not to, or boys.
I think there's two aspects to it. One is that the diagnostic criteria were very much written based on the way autism presents in males. We'll stick with those terms.
Yeah, we'll stick with
those. We'll acknowledge that those terms are not very inclusive and they're very limiting, but just for the purposes of the way the diagnostic criteria works. The diagnostic criteria were written for males. And a lot of the things in them are easily missed amongst females, and also there's the masking issue. So even if you look at things like, we look at things like obsessive interests and repetitive behaviours, and so a little boy who talks all the time about trains or dinosaurs or collects them, that's seen as, okay, that's symptomatic, that's a problem. But a lot of girls' interest... So if a girl is interested in flowers or dolls or jewellery or a lot of the things that we think of as stereotypically female, that's not seen as unusual. It's not seen as a special interest or an obsession or something that's problematic. If we read a lot, we collect lots of books, well, that's seen as good, isn't it? And girls... tend to internalise rather than externalise. So, one of the best definitions that I ever heard about autism, and I'm totally opposed to functioning labels, I think they're horrible, but when we talk about autism, you know, if we talk about levels of autism, it's about not how much my autism impacts me, it's how much my autism impacts you, right? So, autism is a problem as much as it impacts other people. So a boy who has externalising behaviours and he makes a lot of noise and he's disruptive in class and his behaviour impacts on other people, teachers are going to say, oh, there's something, we need to get a diagnosis, we need to get support, we need to get treatment. But a girl who sits there very quietly in class and she takes on all the social pressure to herself and she thinks, oh, I need to try harder, I need to fit in, and she's very quiet and she doesn't ask for help and she doesn't... Well, nobody's going to see that she's a problem because her autism is only a problem for her. It's not a problem for anybody else. So nobody's going to pick it up, right? And the masking thing, girls are supposed to be good, aren't they? Girls are supposed to be quiet and well-behaved and follow rules. And so we do that and we learn that. And, our society hasn't changed that much in hundreds of years. We're still... Girls get congratulated for being good and for being quiet and for being like everyone else. And so, we're taught all our lives that we need to fit in and we need to comply and we need to behave. And so we learn that the things about us that are different and that aren't the way we should just hide them, and we should cover them up. And we girls are very good at copying other people and learning that that's the right way to behave. And one of the really common things you hear from parents of autistic girls is that they, at school, they behave perfectly. You know, and the school says there's no problem with this child. You know, they're so good and they're so quiet and they're all behaved. And their parents come home, say they come home and they turn into an absolute nightmare. And that's because they're absolutely exhausted from masking at school all day. They come home and they let go. And I think the reason that so many of us are diagnosed in our 40s or later is we've spent our whole lives masking, right? And we just get to the point that we're so flipping exhausted that it starts to drop. You know, a lot of people have said to me, do you think we get more autistic as we get older? And I don't think that's true at all. I think we're exactly the same amount of autistic all the way through. I think we just get worn out from masking, and that's why it becomes obvious as we get older. Like, I'm sick and tired of pretending I don't need a fidget in my hand to stop me from being stressed. I'm sick and tired of pretending that I can put up with the bright lights and everything else, and then spending every single night in bed from when I get home from work. You know, you get tired.
Thank you, Sandra. That was, I have to admit, that was really heartbreaking to hear that about girls in particular, of and that is such a, I think, helpful way of understanding why girls are so late to be diagnosed, because they're the ones trying to, you know, it's only impactful on them. So, you know, that is, you know, it does. It really hits home, because I think a lot of us probably have people that we're thinking of that we love that we go, oh, okay. I wanted to ask too about object attachment, which I love. And I'd love you to explain a little bit of object attachment and tell us a little bit about your object attachment.
Okay. So, again, not all autistic people are the same, but I found most of the autistic people I know are like this. We get very attached to things. My things are they I'm not saying I'm like, I don't think that they're alive, although sometimes maybe I do. But I do tend to get very attached to things, and they give me a sense of security and stability. So the world is a crazy place, right? There's so much of it is unpredictable. And so having things that are safe and secure and I know where they are and what they are, they become very, very important to me. So I have my chair at home, right? It might look like all the other chairs, but that's my chair and I sit in my chair. And if someone else sits in my chair, that's just wrong, right? That just makes me feel really, really uncomfortable. If someone else drinks out of my cup. Now, we have a set of cups. They all look the same to everyone else, except each one's a different colour. Now, mine is pink, right? You can't drink out of my cup. If you do, you can just go home, right? Because the pink one is mine, and it might look to you like all the other ones, but that's my cup. And I love my cup. My cup and I, we have this bond. It's really important to me. And my kids and I, we're the same. And my husband, he's not autistic. He doesn't. To him, objects are just objects. They're just things, right? So, like, if I break something, it's like something that, like, a cup. It's like tragedy, right? I broke the cup. My husband, he breaks something. It's like, oh, no deal. No big deal. We'll get another one. And yeah, and like phones, he'll just pick up somebody's phone and start updating the software because he's a techie guy. And I'm like, but that's my phone. That's mine, my phone. And it's not like I think he's doing anything sinister to it. It's just it's mine and he touched it and it might not be the same when I get it back. I hate software updates for the same reason. I don't know about anyone else, but have you seen Twitter changed its logo?
Yes.
Oh, like, for me, that is just...
You can't do that.
No, it's just really... I'm in shock. Like, it really... So, yeah, objects are very important.
I just want to get a show of hands out there who... Because I'm with you on the cup thing. Like, if you can't have my cup, like, that's my... Has anyone got a cup? Yeah. Like, if someone else touches their cup? Yeah. I have a point of connection on the cup when you said that. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And Twitter. Cup and Twitter. Actually, in having this conversation, it makes you reflect back too, because I think there, you know, there were whole generations that went through in our families completely without any understanding of what that person was going through. My grandfather, for instance, who I didn't know where to put this person. He locked himself in a room for 6 weeks. And when he came out, he didn't speak for 40 years. He didn't speak to my grandmother for 40 years, right? Absolutely no. They lived together. He had his chair, his cup, like he never touched it. He made 52 concrete mushrooms around the backyard, including a complete mushroom barbecue setting, right? None of us twigged. When he got the Demtel glass cutter, he made sculptures that I cannot repeat, but it was quite bizarre. And then he didn't say hello, goodbye, please or thank you or use your name. So he only would blurt. If he had to say something, he would go, move the car. That would be it. And it's only now, he's long dead since then, I feel this. I had no. He scared me actually because I couldn't connect with him. But it's only now that I go, he's clearly autistic. Like he had. Now I'm reading. I was thinking of my grandfather going, how sad and what a loss it has been for people to have to live in a world where they were exiled. Like this is the opportunity of moving forward.
Yeah, I think that that's so true. You know, it's if I look at the difference, I'm so in awe of young people. There are some really active autism advocates who are significantly younger than me, and just in awe of how confident they are to be able to kind of claim their identity and go out there and kind of make it safer for young people. Oh. I wish that was around when I was young. I think, wow, if at, you know, 10 or 15 or 20, I could have been able to say, hey, actually, I'm not broken. I'm like that person. You know, I'm like Chloe Hayden. I'm okay. That would have been amazing.
I know. Look at Greta Thunberg, one of the most inspirational young women of our generation. Mm. Amazing heroes with autism.
And to have been able to be able to go through your life thinking, oh, okay, I'm all right. I look back and I think I would have lived my life so much differently if I wasn't constantly thinking there's something wrong with me.
Oh, Sandra, thank you so much today. Can you please put your hands together for Sandra Tom Jones?
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.